This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine.
Hurry in for exceptional offers through December 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
It's better over here.
Now at T-Mobile, get four 5G phones on us and four lines for $25 a line per month when you switch with eligible trade-ins. All on America's largest 5G network.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees and $10 device connection charge. Phones via 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. Bill credits end if you pay off devices early. See T-Mobile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You can find him on YouTube, Lance Braz. Also, player development analyst for the Marquee Network, and a return to the Baseballs and Boring podcast because, Lance, you were the straw that stirred the drink when it came to the conversation of the guys last year. Shota Imanaga and Yamamoto, you were the guy who educated us in what we were about to see. So thank you for that. Thank you for all that you do. Thank you for all that you do. And it's good to see you. That's a long introduction, but it's good.
It's great to see you, Rob. How you doing, man? Yeah, this will be fun. The MPB guys coming over always create a lot of interest because it's like an unknown commodity to some extent. So it's cool when you get some access to the data and can see what they're actually doing.
You know, what's interesting is I was talking to last week, we did a podcast with Galen Carr, player personnel guy for the Dodgers. And we were reflecting on when he was with the Red Sox when Matsuzaka came over. And compared to, obviously, they were in the middle of the Yamamoto stuff last year and how different it was. It was like the mystery of Daisuke Matsuzaka compared to the opportunity to have breakdowns like you gave of Yamamoto and Imanaga and these guys. It's so incredible, right?
I mean, the advancement's crazy. You know, you can learn a lot about a pitcher just by looking at like individual data traits. And of course, you're going to have to overlap in coaching and biomechanical analysis, et cetera, to like fully actualize that guy's potential. But I mean, we've come so far in terms of that stuff. You know, back in the day with none of that data, you're pretty blind, I think, on a lot of the guys coming over.
So when you look at going through it last year, because I felt like last year, we've obviously had guys come over, but last year was that was on the radar so much, I think mostly because of Yamamoto. Although it was so awesome to hear you talk about Imanaga. Like to that point, it was like Yamamoto. Oh, by the way, there's this other guy. And then Imanaga obviously ends up turning out to be, up until the end, like really like the guy. You compare it to like last year to this year, when we're going to talk about Roki Sasaki, is there any? It hasn't even taken it up a notch, or is it? Does it just feel like last year all over again?
I mean, I think it's because he's the only. I mean, maybe there's some other guys that come over, but he's such a differentiated prospect from MPB that I do think it's a different situation. Like last year, you know, the contract the Dodgers gave Yamamoto, I think for the most part, created validity around how good he was, and they paid that off. You know, he was injured, etc. But they really expanded out his mix. He looked great, I thought, at the end of the year. They gave him a really nasty sweeper. You know, there's a lot of, like, foundational tools that he had that I thought the Dodgers would latch onto and adjust off of. Imanaga was, like, a little bit more of just a unique one-pitch guy, in my opinion, with that fastball from his low slot. And that's what just would work, you know. And Wrigley Field played very pitcher-friendly this year. So I'm kind of fascinated to see how he looks next year and whether there's more interest in maybe mixing in a couple of extra pitches or throwing this changeup thing that he's throwing more, or just varying the look of the split to create some more confusion for hitters. Sasaki is like your crazy hard throwing, not as precise command as Yamamoto, just pretty much a splitter. I know he throws a slider. I just think that thing needs to be reworked. And I imagine any team that picks him up is probably going to play around with it. But he's like an electric arm, whereas Yamamoto is like precision and pedigree and results. And Imanaga was like, he's odd, and maybe this is a really good value situation. So to me, they're very, very different pitchers, all of them.
Okay, we love power rankings. So give me, before we get into Sasaki and you already sort of set the scene for him, power rank the hype meter. Like this is like, and really we're going to talk about two, right? Because I'm not going to put Imanaga like at that in with it because he would be number three. But give me the hype meter compare of Yamamoto compared to Sasaki, because I remember going back a couple years ago, Yamamoto was everything. It was everything.
Sure.
Except they would say, but you really got to see this 19-year-old. So
I mean,
where would you
that's the
put this
thing.
at?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's just an odd situation. I feel like to be honest, like when you look at the media side, what drives a lot of the hype is like the monetary dollar, right? Like the ability to get over a $300 million contract for a guy like Yamamoto drives a lot of the hype. It drives all the headlines because it's a weirder situation with Sasaki, where he's going to be posted, we presume, early on December 15th in the new international period, where his max signing bonus is going to be under like $6.5 million, whatever. It's just a very different situation where I think the hype's greater for him as a pitcher because there's more upside for him on the whole, in my opinion, from like you get him at 23 years old, wherever he is, for the next probably 6 years, and you get him on a really cheap, like crazy, crazy discounted rate. So it opens up like the entire league. Whereas I feel like what fuels the media hype machine is like $300 million going to the Dodgers, Yankees. There's only like three teams that can afford it. It's a major market situation. MLB is probably going to be like slightly disappointed if this guy ends up on like the Brewers or maybe not the Orioles. The Orioles are on the up and up and stuff. But that's still like on the East Coast markets. That's what the fifth most important team, So I don't know. I'm fascinated to see. I would say, from a media hype perspective, Sasaki seems to be, for some reason, a tick below Yamamoto and Imanaga to me. Just in my head, trying to recollect as to what we were thinking about last year. But from like a player upside standpoint, to me, he's the hype's greater. So I guess I answered that on my own terms
No,
in two ways, but.
I think it's great because it is two different situations. Like it is, there was definitely the hype of the courting of like how much money is he going to make? Oh my goodness, he's only 24, 25 years old. And but now this is along the lines of going back to Ohtani, sort of, where this isn't about the money. This is going to be, a team has a chance, which makes it in some ways a lot better. It like makes it a lot better of you're hearing these reports about, well, he just wants it doesn't it can be the smallest market, but if you show them that your pitching development is next level, who knows? Maybe you're gonna end
Exactly.
up with the Royals. I don't know, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, that's the key, right? He's going to go to the team that has that best pitch for him. So I'm kind of fascinated to see where he ends up. I mean, some of the teams that I think the Red Sox have a reasonable shot. I think, there's some other teams that are like the Cubs, I think, have a really good shot. Like they've courted a pair of Japanese players already. Joel Wolf, Seiya Suzuki's agent. Like there's connections there. Like I think they're going to have a pretty good opportunity along with the Red Sox. And Orioles make a lot of sense. From a pitching development standpoint, I'm basically thinking of the teams that like have great pitching development, and I can imagine putting together a presentation that's like, hey, compared to what you had with the Marines, like we're completely next level. We'll be able to get you, a $300 million contract when you become a free agent at the age of 29 or whatever. Like that's probably the pitch that he wants to hear the most, is like, which team am I invested in over the next 6 year period? And there's some other teams on the good PD side that I maybe like the Rays. I don't know if they're going to be able to convince them that they're playing in Steinbrenner Field for this coming year. Like that seems like a big downtick, although that's a really good org. So I'm fascinated to see where he ends up. I think there's a lot of teams that have a shot, and that makes it fun.
But you know what, Lance? The thing is that I kind of want him to see him go to somewhere that we're not expecting. But the reality is that what you're talking about, the development of, I've heard so many times with free agents about, well, this one team, they just laid out a scenario. They laid out the machines. They laid out the process. They laid out that they have more than anybody else, better than everybody else. And that was one of the big market teams. That's the Los Angeles Dodgers. That's the team everyone's like, he's going. And like, so it's not why everyone says, oh, well, look, Yamamoto's there. Ohtani's there. He's going to go there. I do believe that he's going to prioritize development, but, and you tell me, like you tell me where in your mind the Dodgers sit develop pitching development wise compared to these other teams, if they're head and shoulders, if they're the same, if whatever. But that to me, like, I keep hearing that about the Dodgers for the last few years, and that's hard to ignore.
No, I totally agree. They're number one. I don't know how big the gap is. That's a really good question to try to think about how to quantify that. I would say it's not massive to the next team, but they're definitely in the top tier, and they're the one of that top tier, in my opinion. And that it does have an influence, right? But the thing I run into a bit, I know they're like already rumors they're going to a six-man rotation. I feel like anytime I look at my YouTube comments or anything, any prospect I mentioned, or excuse me, not prospect, free agent I mentioned, everyone's just like, well, he's going to the Dodgers, like Max Fried, Walker Buehler, Roky Sasaki. I just don't think. There's no way the Dodgers are signing all of these pitchers. To me, in my perspective, I'm like Brandon Gomes or any of these other guys thinking about that. Like, you have to pick the guys that you want.
Right.
And I think Sasaki's at the top of that list because of the dollar side, because it's so cheap, because you get this kind of prospect. I'm confident they'd be able to develop him into a better pitcher. I think he would be confident he'd become a better pitcher in that organization. But I think, I don't know if we have public markets like a DraftKings or whatever marketing this, like coming up with odds. I thought I saw somewhere that the Dodgers were like a 4-1, which I think converts to like a 30% chance or something like that. So that's like the actual factual information around if you want to be able to get money down, have skin in the game around this situation is like the Dodgers are clearly the favorite. From my vantage point, it seems like the market is overcorrecting for how likely it is the Dodgers get him. And I don't know if that's just a negotiating thing by Joe Wolf to say, like, you got to lay out a good plan. Who knows? But at the end of the day, to me, like I think most people, if you give them 50%, like a coin flip odds on 50% Dodgers or 50% rest of the league, I think most teams would take, most people in baseball would take the Dodgers in that situation at 50-50 odds. For me, I would take the rest of the league at 50%. And I think that's maybe a more objective, like info around like what is the actual probability he ends up on the Dodgers. I think it's below 50%, but that's a byproduct of the fact that there's probably, let's say, 15 other teams I think have a realistic shot. So it's an interesting situation for that reason. I'm not, if I had to predict, I'd say he's not a Dodger next year, but I get why that's the favorite. I understand the logic behind it.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. I mean, it's almost too obvious. And also, I think that to your point, the gap is narrowed. I can say the Dodgers are at the top, the gap is narrowed in terms of these other teams where players and pitchers are going to these teams that you wouldn't expect and said, man, I learned a lot. I learned a lot with the Brewers. I learned a lot with the Mets, maybe big market team, not a great example. I learned a lot with the Twins. I learned, these sort of
Sure.
things. So even the Cubs. I want to come back to our first impressions of him. I said that I remember people saying, and maybe this was WBC talk, I can't remember, about you got to see this kid. You got to see this kid. For you, it's a cliche question. Like, when do you remember first having this guy get on your radar?
Great question. I actually have no idea. I'm trying to think about this now. Probably when I was looking at Yamamoto last year, I think. I imagine I looked a little bit at Sasaki. I think I looked at his, oh, it was WBC 2023. So does that line up with the timeline? No, that's earlier then. So 2023, I remember looking at his data and being pretty astounded. So that was early 2023. I would say that's the first like true introduction I got. And I'm not everyone saying handicapped by the data, but I definitely rely on that more. So I wait for that information to help me like inform what my eyes are seeing. I think that's a great way to approach a lot of analysis and such. So yeah, the WBC data for him was unbelievable. He was sitting 100 miles per hour. We only got like 100 pitches tracked, so to speak. But to me, like one of the key things that jumps out about him is how unique the splitter is relative to the fastball. I feel like I've seen a lot of things in the industry of people like trying to talk through his mix. And I think a lot of people are really missing the point here with him because the difference between him and other fastball split pitchers is the fact that his fastball is a lot of like total movement. So it rides and it runs a lot. Whereas you think Yamamoto's a little bit more of a pure carry guy, less arm side movement on his fastball, or at least more average. Sasaki's fastball is like almost two plane. And most of the time with those two plane type fastballs, which you'll see off that is a splitter that's like kind of also running arm side. It has similar arm side movement to the four seam, maybe slightly different. Sasaki's splitter is like a cut splitter. It's like a Hurston Waldrop splitter. Some of these other, like Logan Gilbert, some of these guys that almost cut their fastball a little and create a much less arm side moving split. That is a huge thing, I think, to point out with him from like a uniqueness standpoint that I really couldn't find another pitcher in MLB that has something similar to that. And he's stated in 2023 and even in some of the regression that he had in 2024, that same idea was still there. So it's that's where I come down on him. It's like that is the key thing to point out is like the splitter is super unique, doesn't actually spin the ball that well, which is something that I think is just going to force him to not end up with like the Yamamoto sweeper and just go towards more like a hard slider. And the team acquiring him, there's a lot of this talk I've heard. Eric Longenhayne had a great nugget on Effectively Wild about potentially them, the Chiba Lotte Marines having a physio guy that like had him tone down velo. My big issue with that is, like, I wouldn't expect fastball shape to regress this much if you tone down velo. So, you know, think of it this way, like, deuced vertical break is like this nerd concept of ride, Nolan Ryan fastball, get that up in the zone, ton of carry, et cetera, et cetera. You measure that on like a second basis. So the faster the ball is, the less time it has to move. So that's why a guy like Shota, if he's sitting like 91, 92, has more time for that ball to carry, you know? So like that is something to consider. He drops 2 miles per hour, but he's not getting more ride. So to me, something fundamentally changed in his throw that I think affected his fastball performance in MPB in 2024. So if you're an organization looking at him and you're pitched to him, I think you're talking about this very point. And that goes into the whole idea of like, what is the front office doing for this guy, right? Understanding what he was doing in the offseason. What did Chiba actually adjust with him, if anything? Did they actually want him sitting at 97 instead of 99? How did that affect his throw? Like, there's a lot of variables here. They're super important, I think, to the analysis of him. I unfortunately don't have answers to them. I just think it's really important to bring them up as opposed to just saying, like, he's generational. He's going to be great. It's like, you kind of got to fix him to some extent. But if you do fix him and you get anything like 2023 WBC data, this dude is like a top 10 pitcher baseball. It's not close. Like, he's electric. It's just there's some subtle things I think that are really important that organizations are thinking about with him that I don't think we're doing a great job of highlighting on the public side.
So would it be fair? I know that he's basically a couple years younger than Yamamoto was. Would it be fair that you say, well, the guy that you're getting maybe isn't as polished. The guy that you're getting, there is a little bit more risk than Yamamoto, but the upside is potentially bigger. Is maybe.
Yeah, that's a great way to phrase it. Yep.
Yeah.
All right. I like that. Yep. It's perfect.
So last year, you actually had a great, because I remember when we talked, everyone was like, kind of like Daisuke was really back and heading into 2007. Oh man, like, you don't understand. Like, this is, he has 11 pitches. He has a gyro ball. He can't miss. And as we found out, there were some red flags. And I think that last year when we talked to Yamamoto, it was the first time that he had surfaced red flags are strong, but hey, you got to watch this, much like you just did with Sasaki. So along those lines, like, is there anything more beyond what you said when it comes to, okay, you get this guy, this is a thing, you know, if you get the version that we last saw, this is a thing that you have to not worry about, but this is a thing that you have to be a heads up, because it rarely goes stem to stern, no doubt about it. You're going to be the best pitcher in baseball because everyone, it's the myth that you created. What is the thing that you might surface right now?
I mean, it's the fastball shape from 2024. Like, that is the thing. If that's not fixed back to 2023, or he doesn't figure it out at lower velo, like, I just, like, that pitch missed, like, so the average swinging strike rate, right? You just take how many times he threw that pitch, how many times does he miss a bat, right? Create that as a.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Jed Lipinski. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
It's better over here.
After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at tmobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device credit service ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
This holiday, BMW has reunited 3 members of the family at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. BMW,
the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through December 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
Percentage. Average in MLB somewhere around like 11 to 12%. NPB is comparable. Those hitters are much more contact oriented, but we don't see massive regression when guys come over stateside. I can confirm this through a lot of the Yamamoto and Senga data that I saw. So Sasaki's fastball went from like 13% over an NPB in 2023 down to like 7%.
Really?
That's not good. So yeah. Like if he posts a 7% swinging strike rate forcing fastball in Major League Baseball, he's going to struggle. Like unequivocally, he's not going to be able to throw a split 60% of the time. That's why I go back to the point of like, you're an organization looking at him. This is what you are trying to figure out. And I wish I talked to, and I'm going to, more people in organizations about how exactly they're like going about scouting him and thinking about him as a pitcher from a development standpoint. But I'm telling you, this is the thing you got to nail as an organization is what do you want to do with this fastball? You know, and that, and it's not even that. I think it's more about understanding, like, again, everything I mentioned about like this, how did Sheba manage him? What is his offseason programming? Are there drill packages that you can add to him in this offseason, sign him early and get him on? So when he shows up in camp in early February or wherever, like he's ready to go and like he's made some substantive changes that you want him to make on certain elements of his delivery or how his body moves, how his arm unravels. Like there's various subtle things here that I think are really important for a team to nail. So for me, it's not all in the fastball shape, but like a lot of his 2025 projection to me is on fastball shape.
And you don't think, like you had mentioned, teaching Yamamoto the sweeper, and but you don't think because of the way that his repertoire already is that that's necessarily going to be like, oh no, it worked for him, let's do it with Sasaki. No,
fundamentally different pitchers, and this is a key thing to point out. Yamamoto spins the ball up at like 2800. That sweeper he was throwing at the end of the year is 2800. I think the average is like 2650, 2700. So he's an above average spin rate guy, which means he's able to hold like what you call supination at release really well. He's able to spin the ball, which creates the potential for movement, not necessarily actual movement, you know, depending on a variety of other dirt stuff we don't have to get into. Sasaki, on the other hand, over at MVB this year, his slider spin was under 2000 RPM. That is like bottom 5%, might even be bottom like 2% in MLB. That matters. In the prior year, he was up at like 2,100. So you had some spin regression as well, probably tied to the velocity. Those two variables are often tied together. So for me, the potential movement he'd be able to get on like a big sweeper is not nearly as much as you'd be able to get with a guy like Yamamoto going to the slider he went through mid the year and then flipping that into more of a sweeper that he's probably going to show in 2025. So for me, I like the concept of him going to the Dodgers because I think they are able to figure out these guys pretty nicely, right? They're able to get them to just rip a really hard cutter pitch like in between a slider. Don't go towards more sweep because you're not going to get it. You don't spin the ball well. Well, let's rip that thing. Let's get the thing up to like 93. You know, if you're sitting 97, let's go like 91, 93. Get it in a really nice territory where it's hard. Helps you against right-handed hitters away. Hopefully you can locate it well enough, and maybe they go towards more like a tweener curve. I think he had a curve. He didn't throw too much, apparently, from my understanding after talking to some people. You can break that back out. I just don't think it's ever going to be like a deep count pitch for him. More like early count, get me over strike stealer, and then it's figuring out this slider. Maybe go towards more like a downer death ball-y shape that we've heard a lot about. There's a whole like ambiguous area in this like slider cutter area that I think a team is going to try to play around with, and maybe they start him with whatever grip he was throwing in MPB, but by the end of the year, I would imagine that pitch starts to change. Because again, the main thing here is going to be figuring out right-handed hitters. I think the split's so good that it doesn't really matter against lefties too much. Again, fastball is going to matter a bit, but he could probably get away with like 40-45% split in the way Senga's gone away with 35-45% of this forkball thing against lefties. He hasn't really had a problem, you know? So to me, it's like slider to righties. He threw this thing 25% of the time over an MPB last year. That's the slider I'm talking about that I think probably needs some kind of adjustment when he comes over stateside. So, yeah, there's concerns here for sure. Like, there's risk in this guy. But I think the upside is crazy if a team can figure it out. And that's what you're betting on because the cost is so low. So from, like, a marginal advantage perspective of you as an organization, like, even if this guy busts out, even if he's a reliever, if he turns into, like, a good closer fastball split type, like, he's paying off the dollars you're giving him by a large margin. So I it's such an easy slam dunk for any org, you know, from a dollar standpoint. And I think that's how a lot of them are going to approach the situation.
That's awesome perspective. I love that. I love that, you know, this is why you're so good at what you do. And by the way, once again, go to the YouTube channel, Lance Braz, awesome stuff. And I'm not just saying that. I don't just say awesome stuff. It is like awesome. It is. It's just like what you said. I mean, what you just gave the primary example of this. I think that the danger that we run into, Lance, is that we get these guys and we just, like when Sasaki was, he's going to be posted. And everyone was, oh my, this is going to change everything. Well, let's look at this. Let's look at exactly what you're getting. And along those lines, I do want to go back to a year later with Yamamoto, because you had mentioned integrating the sweeper. You had a great familiarity, great analysis of him coming in, and then then they add the sweeper. So what he did was evolve. That's great. But looking back now about his year, what surprise, other than integrating that pitch, what surprised you about Yamamoto, if anything? Maybe it was the year that you thought he was going to have. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I thought he looked really good. I think the injury was a little bit discouraging, a little bit. You know, like we don't have a ton of. It's one of these things. You get into this area of like predicting injuries. I think you start talking a lot of like not really too confident language, you know, from my perspective, thinking of very objectively of like, how do we predict injuries and such? And we don't have a ton of like public information on this because we don't get biomechanical data of any kind. So we can't really tie that back to ball velo, et cetera. I know Driveline Baseball is like an open biomechanics database and stuff. You can kind of back into it. As you throw harder, you create more torque in your arm. Just there's variables between guys. Like every guy isn't creating the exact same amount of torque on their arm. One thing that I do think has surfaced in some of the public data is that like smaller pitchers tend to break down a little more. I've seen this in some of, you know, Sarah's pieces and the Athletic and stuff he's mentioned a couple times. It's very baseline analysis. Again, it's so high level that I don't think you could specify it down to any guy. But that's like a subtle worry with Yamamoto, especially on a team like the Dodgers where they need him in the playoffs, right? Is like, is he ever going to get past 160 innings, you know? Like, I don't know. I doubt any Dodger pitcher next year throws like 140, maybe 130 innings as a starting pitcher because they're so postseason focused. You know, like they're just trying to get these guys into some bit of a peak shape for late in the year. So perhaps that has some implication on like how good he is in a regular season. But I still think he's a really good pitcher. I thought they did a great job with some of the expansion of his repertoire as the year went on. I really like the sinker he added. Again, the slider he brought that in like mid-season-ish. Really good pitch. Then I think he got hurt. When he came back from injury, they just went really simple with him. It was like fastball curve split. And then you started to see at the end of the year that they started going a little more sweep with it, which was something happened right before the injury as well. So that repertoire, I think, is going to be pretty deep this coming year. Like I'd expect to see more sink. I expect to see more slider, maybe even more sweepers separated out from another slider on top of the curve to righties specifically. That's the target they're always going to try to figure out with him. Because again, split's so good, he's not going to have too much problem versus lefties. Doesn't really need that much versus lefties. But I'm super happy with who he is as a pitcher. I think for the most part, he's probably going to pay off the dollar value they gave him. He's really good.
It is striking what you said, like the size. When I first stood next to him, I think it was in spring training, and then I was reminded again in the postseason. I mean, if you compare him to the rest of major league pitchers, he is a small guy. He is like, in it's almost we build these guys up when we don't see him. Like, oh, no, they're saying he's not tall, but he must be bigger than that. No, if he's 6 feet, God bless him.
You think about it, like Luis Castillo is always the name that comes to mind for me as like, well, this guy was kind of small and like succeeded and he's thrown 150 innings and 40s in a row, but like he's also 6'2". You know, like I always underrate that element of him. I know he's a little bit of a leaner, lighter side guy, but yeah, I mean, there's like Marcus Stroman's probably one of the most successful undersized pitchers. And like, he hasn't been great the last couple of years. He's been super up and down. He's dealt with a lot of injuries. So I'm not entirely sure. Like that's the element that's creates some variability. But again, if you're going to put that guy in any org, you'd be confident that he can pitch 150 innings over the course of a regular season and postseason. If there's an org to figure it out, it's probably the Dodgers, getting back to our point about them being best.
I'm not saying I'm confident, and especially that you mentioned like getting to the finish line. The one thing the Dodgers had going for them when they got to game five and the Yankees were up 5-0, and you're like, well, it's going back to LA. But I still said, well, the good thing for the Dodgers is that they have the guy who is pitching the best for them, pitching. And that's Yamamoto. Yamamoto was hitting his stride along with Walker Buehler. Like, they were hitting their stride at the right time, at the perfectly right time. I'm not saying that was going to lead them to victory, but boy, that would have, he was pitching. He was, Lance, like at the end, he was a different pitcher, but the image that you were getting of him was exactly what you were signing up for, right?
Yeah. That's spot on. Yeah. Don't even add anything there. You nailed it.
So last thing is the other guy, you were really bullish on Imanaga. I remember that. Like you were, and obviously he comes out of the gate And there was sort of maybe there was a little bit of a Senga hangover, a little bit from, and we shouldn't classify all these, like all the pitches coming from Japan in the same bucket, but there was, oh yeah, you know, that's, he's an interesting guy, but his results in Japan wasn't exactly what, it certainly wasn't when Yamamoto was, but he's an interesting guy. I remember that you liked him a lot, and sure enough, he was really, really, really good, and he did hold up a Japanese baseballs and boring t-shirt, which we appreciate. So, which by the way, that, please remind me, I got to get you, if anyone deserves one of those.
That'd be great.
Yeah, yeah. Joe Kelly wore this every single day, with the hope that Otani would say, yes, Joe, I like your t-shirt, let me put it on. But same question with Imanaga. What is the thing now, a year later, what is it, what was your perspective of him?
Again, like living in and working for the Cubs network here, it's one of those things where and Jed Hoyer said this as well in his season presser. This is a really weird year for this organization to like analyze what happened, because this park was very odd. It played as, I believe, the second most pitcher-friendly park in baseball this season. Their pitching staff was pretty good. It wasn't great. You'd expect almost when this happened, like, for them to just absolutely dominate, but they had some reliever trouble, et cetera. Their home run splits, I don't think, were dramatically different, but it's one of those things where Jed seemed to almost allude to at his end of season presser that, you know, I'm sure they measure the wind all the time at the field, but it seemed like most of their home games it was blowing in, and most of the time they were away at Wrigley Field, like say they were playing in St. Louis or something like that, Wrigley Field was actually blowing out. So it's like you get this odd situation where if next year you just assume that Wrigley goes back to being a neutral park, then I'm slightly worried about Imanaga's like 1.5 homer per nine. Like these guys with these carry fastballs, sometimes when they miss, like they do give up barrels on them. I see this like Taj Bradley and a ton of other guys. It's like, it's just a byproduct of who he is as a pitcher. Like Nick Pivetta who's always run a pretty high homer per nine in his career, you know, now a free agent, very good pitcher. I love Nick Pivetta a lot. He's better than average pitcher. But at the same time, like you just run into home run problems with these guys often. So the fact that Imanaga got below like a 3 ERA in one of the most pitcher-friendly parks makes me think that there's probably some natural regression coming here, and he's maybe more like 3.5 to 4 ERA. But that's not to discourage the point here that like they got him on an incredible deal, and he's much better than I believe the league assumed he possibly would be. So I do think you have a little bit of a cloudy situation in terms of the park and how that affected him overall. But the net of everything is to who he is as a pitcher for the dollar value, et cetera, if you're looking at it from an organizational standpoint, no doubt a hit, you know? I don't know how much more there is to do to his mix, right? He's already got fastball split. He's got his changeup he started throwing, which moves very similar to the split at a higher spin. Seems to just be like a visual thing to change up looks. Curveball sweeper. You know, he's never going to be a breaking ball guy. He's never going to need those because he doesn't face a lot of left-handed hitters. So it's a simple approach. It's fastball split change to righties, and that's what you got to focus on. He's going to face them 70% of the time, and we'll see if he gives up more or less than 1.5 homer per nine, and that's really going to influence a lot of it.
Yeah, listen, I mean, like, to your point, what they invested in him, you got a guy who, at very least, is going to be – I always go back, can the guy pitch in the postseason? If you get there, there you go. He can.
No question. Yeah, he's in the rotation for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So the last things, we're going to come back to the last power ranking. Top-tier free agents, okay?
Okay.
Top-tier, and tell me if I'm forgetting someone. You got Corbin Burns. I mean, all around the same age, right? Corbin Burns, Max Fried. We'll throw Blake Snell in there. Who am I missing? You mentioned Pivetta, but I would.
There's one more there. I just did a video on this where I had. Yeah, Flaherty's in there. Flaherty, Fried, Burns, and who's the fourth?
Snell.
That's probably the top tier, in my opinion. Top four.
All right. Give me your power rankings. If you're the GM, you know, assuming. You know, I don't want to get into like, oh, well, you know, Snell's a little bit older. So, no, just the guy that you would say, we need a top of the rotation pitch. You want to allocate resources to the top of the rotation pitcher. Give me the.
I'm going to go Burns. Like, I feel like I've been meaning to write something about this or whatnot, but I do think the industry is kind of like over calculating on how much this guy dropped his swing and a miss. I get that's like the clear trend, and it's very obvious over the last couple of years that his swing and miss has fallen. From just look at strikeout rate over here, last three seasons for him, it went from like, you know, I'm not sure off the top of my head, let's say it went from like, it just trickled down every year, 30% to like 28 to 26 or whatever it is this most recent season, you know? It's just not a great trend, but I don't necessarily think that's like a massive issue for him. He is a swing and miss pitcher. But at the same time, like, his bread and butter has always been this weird cutter. And I just think he has the aptitude and the ability to figure out the rest of his mix. He's made adjustments in each of the last 2 years, intra-season, like within that season. Last All-Star break, added a sinker, reshaped his slider, started throwing a sweeper. You know, this year into Baltimore, went back to the old slider. And then end of the year, you saw him go back to the sweeper, which is a nasty pitch. Didn't really throw the sinker a ton, but I still really like that offering. I just think his aptitude is really good. He's an absolute horse from an innings perspective. So I might just be playing like devil's advocate slightly. And like, all I see is like, well, I don't know if I'd pay Burns because the strikeout rate has dropped. But I just like, maybe there's a way to get it back. Maybe it's throwing the sweeper for the whole year. Does his body hold up if he does that? Probably, you know, especially if he's going to a smart org that can actually figure out how to phase that in and out, et cetera. So he's my guy. Like, I feel like I'm going to do something on him eventually where it's like the downfall is a bit over exaggerated to me. So it's him for me. And then it's Snell. And then it's Fried. Then it's Flaherty.
Snell over Fried. Yeah. Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, Fried is like, again, maybe I'm leaning a little, this is going to counteract my Burns point of like, I'm not super worried about the strikeouts, but Snell, I just think the rap on Snell has always been a little, again, another situation where I maybe have a different perspective where everyone's like, oh, he doesn't actually have like great command or anything. And I just think Snell's a smart pitcher where like, he's not going to throw bad pitches in the zone when he's behind in the count. Like, if you just look at what he does behind in the count, he does not really push fastball use. So you don't even care if he walks you because he knows he can hit the shadows with other pitches that are very good in the slider and the changeup. And he's another guy each of these last two seasons has done a really good job of tinkering and tweaking things and playing around with the usage. It's curve slider change. It's multiple pitches. If one is off, I still think he'll be able to survive against righties if the other two are on. You know, I just think he's a really good pitcher and he's continually shown that. And I think last year with the late signing was very odd. Like, he's talked about that, and Montgomery's another guy that talked about that, who's maybe a good value add if a team wants to try to acquire him or something. Because like, there's no chance he wasn't affected by the late start, the late ramp up and stuff.
I mean, when you fire an agent, you rip your agent. Yeah, yeah, no question.
Come on, it's one of those things where it's like, I'm going to basically act as, I'm not going to act as if Jordan Montgomery's 2023 version of himself, but it's definitely not going to be the 2024 Montgomery. And I'll apply the same thing to Snell. So that's where Snell is. And then, I mean, Flaherty and Fried are comparable to me. I'll take Fried above for sure. He's very similar to like Justin Steele here in Chicago in terms of like cutting his fastball. Pretty deep mix guy. I think I'd be curious to see some of his usage trends if he goes to another org. Atlanta like played around with the sweeper last year, which I didn't love. I just didn't think he needed it. He's got a lot of breaking ball feel. Like, he was mixing three or four different shapes there. So I'm curious to see like whoever acquires him, what they prioritize in terms of shape. And then Flaherty, Flaherty's another guy. Like, I thought Tigers did a great job, and I also thought the Dodgers did a great job. That was a cool little difference between throwing curveball and slider and how they, each of those teams viewed the usage of those pitches to lefties and righties specifically. Tigers went one way off the top of my head. I think it was more slider to lefty, less curveball. And then the Dodgers were like, no, we want more curveball to lefty. But at the end of the day, he was good with either organization. So that proves to you again that like teams like the Tigers and the Dodgers are ahead of teams like the Cardinals right now in terms of pitching development. So I think that tier is all in the same area. And I think this lines up with most of like the average annual value projections I've seen, where I don't think it's going to be like Burns gets $30 million a year and then Fried gets 22. Like, they're all going to be within a couple mil of each other. I guess it's more on like which organization wants to give more years and more total dollar value, et cetera. But they're all in the same tier. There's clear differentiation between a Burns and a Flaherty in terms of the top and bottom of the tier. But I think the tier drop is more interesting, where you go down, where it seems like Cubs and some of these other teams are going to be shocking. And the Red Sox, I believe, have said this as well, as like the mid-market pitching tier, where it's like Eovaldi, Shane Bieber, a big incentive-driven contract probably coming off Tommy John. Like, there's a lot of names there that are pretty intriguing. Of course, I want to shop at the top tier of the market, but I don't think every team is going to be willing to give a $250 million contract to some of these guys. So you're going to end up with like an Eovaldi for 2 years at like 16, 17 a pop, you know, like something along those lines. So Kikuchi's another one I know a lot of teams like. I thought the Astros did a great job in terms of their adjustments to him compared to what the Blue Jays were having him do. So yeah, there's a lot of variance, I think, among this is it, right? This is what organizations are staring at. They're staring at their big board, so to speak. We talk about this for draft season all the time in terms of NFL and stuff, but I don't think it's very different in free agency. You're looking at, you know, If you don't already have an idea of like where this guy actually wants to go, whether he wants to play with you, you're doing analysis on like how you'd rank these guys and what tweaks you'd make and how that tweak would adjust your projection. So I love this stuff. It's really fun to think about.
Oh no, it's great. This is unfortunately the offseason's so long. We talk about it for 3 months, but but a couple things. Number one, you're so right about Flaherty and the Tigers, and this is another team maybe we should look at. You know, when the original conversation about which he might be a sleeper.
Yeah, they're up there. Yep.
But I talked to Flaherty because of exactly what we're talking about. Oh, look, you came to the Dodgers. What did they do? You know, I obsess over the Ryan Brazier. They learned to teach him how to hit a cutter, and all of a sudden, boom, boom, boom. Look at the Dodgers. They're magical. And he automatically pivoted it like, no, it was the Tigers. It was the Tigers who changed, like, this. They're the team that I'm giving credit for. And, you know, and then when it comes to Burns, what I like about Burns, and you're right, I think that he's, for lack of a better term, getting crapped on a little bit more than he should in the intrawebs. What I like, which makes isn't analytical and probably doesn't hold a lot of weight, I like the fact that I believe he was the only pitcher that pitched 8 innings in a postseason game. Now, it was one, right? It was one. But what that tells me is that you got to the finish line and you were able to pitch 8 innings and give up one run. Like, kudos to you. Like, because we also have seen other pitchers, and I don't know what he would have done if he pitched 3 or 4 more times. Because look at Sean Manaea. Sean Manaea fell off a cliff, you know, because he had to pitch those extra times. So yeah. I really like that. I don't know why, but I really like that. So
yeah, no, it's good. I totally get it from like a workhorse and like projecting your playoff rotation standpoint, the ability to be confident in a guy turning over a lineup in those spots. Like that's always going to be something we're going to scrutinize for the rest of time, I think, in baseball, because of all the information we have around third time through the order penalties. I do wonder whether a guy like Burns has a unique enough cutter where that just doesn't really lend itself to too much familiarity as you turn over lineups, where guys still have trouble with it the more they see it. I'm not sure if there's been research done on that in terms of cut shapes like this, but I wouldn't be totally surprised if like that's one of his quote-unquote superpowers that allows him to kind of push a little bit harder deep into games and really leverage spots, and you have confidence he'll still be there and he's not going to give up a tank, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, I think the lesson will be learned from the postseason is we obsess over bullpen games and how well they worked and how you have teams like Cleveland and Detroit basically like bob and weave their way through. Ultimately, you do need a couple of those guys. You need the Eovaldi Montgomery dynamic. You needed, you know, the Dodgers for a while, you know, the Flaherty, Yamamoto. You need these guys to protect the bullpen while they're bobbing and weaving through.
Sure.
So anyway, Lance, man, I appreciate the time. You've got me jacked up. Again, go to the YouTube channel. It's awesome. Lance Braz. And if I do anything in this world, it is going to be sending you a Baseballs and Boring Japanese shirt.
So I love it. Yeah. Thanks, man.
I appreciate it.
Good chat.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
For the past 3 seasons of Gone South, we've covered one story per season. Now, Gone South is back for a 4th season. But this time, we're doing things a little differently. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
It's better over here.
Now at T-Mobile, get 4 5G phones on us and 4 lines for $25 a line per month when you switch with eligible trade-ins. All on America's largest 5G network.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees and $10 device connection charge. Phones via 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. Bill credits end if you pay off devices early. See T-Mobile.com.
Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4 packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine.
Hurry in for exceptional offers through December 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.